Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Women made enormous contributions to the war effort during World War II. In addition to supporting families while men went to the front lines, they filled huge gaps in the labor force. Some estimate that by 1945, nearly one out of every four married women worked outside the home. Women also contributed more directly to the war effort through the Women's Air Force Service Pilots, or WASP, program, flying almost every type of military aircraft. And as our recent guest Denise Kernan chronicled in her book, The Girls of Atomic City, women worked surreptitiously during the war at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, on the building of the atomic bomb. Later in the hour, we hear the story of Elizabeth Richardson, who lies among the honored dead in the American cemetery in Normandy, France, and we'll talk with a 93-year-old Falmouth woman who enlisted as a wave in the Navy during World War II. But first, a newly published book chronicles yet another little-known but significant contribution made by women during World War II, the women recruited to work as codebreakers. The book is Code Girls, the untold story of the American women codebreaker of World War II, and author Liza Mundy joins us. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Liza, you're a journalist in addition to being an author, and you've written numerous articles about the changing role of women in our society. Stories about women, particularly women in the workforce, are on your radar. But the women who worked on code breaking during World War II were sworn to secrecy. So how and when did you first find out about them?
Yes, I found out about it when I was talking to an NSA historian. Our federal historians are great sources of articles and stories, and they were telling me about this the effort of more than 10,000 women to come to Washington and break codes during World War II, and I could hardly believe that the story hadn't been told. And I think it was much like the way that Hidden Figures came to be a book, in the sense that people who worked at NASA knew about the female African-American mathematicians who had worked so hard on the space program. But it took an author who wanted to do the work to bring that story to light, to make it public. And it's the same here, in that it was no secret at the NSA that women had broken codes during the war, and that effort would ultimately lead to the creation of the National Security Agency. But because the women had done such a good job of keeping the secret, the story was not out there in the public.
Mm. Yeah, this is in a way similar to the Girls of Atomic City, in that you're working on the secret project. You think, well, who would do that? Who would we work in secret? But if we remember the time during World War II, if somebody said, you're doing this for the war effort, you were going to do it, and you were going to keep it secret.
Absolutely. I mean, the people were so eager to help the war effort. I mean, I interviewed women about this. They tried to evoke for me the incredible sense of patriotism during the war. One of the women said, people were picking up rubber bands on the street to donate to the war effort. They were, donating pots and pans. They were saving bacon grease. And one of the codebreakers in my story, both of her brothers were in the fighting, and the family had actually tried to donate their dog to the war effort to fight as well. Their dog was named Poochie, and they actually received a letter from the War Dog Training Center saying that unfortunately that they had an age limit and Poochie was too right. old. But that just sort of gives a sense of how really people would have dropped anything to serve the war effort. And it was sort of ironically easier for the women to keep a secret, because they were told to tell anybody who asked what they did that they were secretaries, that they emptied waste baskets and sharpened pencils. Mm-hmm. And people certainly were willing to believe that, any work that women were doing was probably not that important.
Yeah. So since this group was so secretive, how did you go about your research, and what were some of the challenges?
Well, the challenge for us was finding the women, and I did so in all sorts of ways. The NSA put me in touch with a couple of women. I literally, though, had a situation where a colleague of mine was visiting her mother at an assisted living facility in Maine. Her mother is a Wellesley, class of 43 graduate, and she was chatting with her mother about my book, and literally two women at the table said, I was involved in that effort, and one of them put her in touch with a third. So she came home and she said, "Well, I've got three people for you to talk to."
Serendipity.
And it was extraordinary. And it did convince me, because many of these women were recruited out of the Seven Sisters schools, out of, Smith and Radcliffe and Bryn Mawr, Mount Holyoke, Wellesley. And I'm sure that in the Boston, Cape Cod, whole northeastern area, I bet that almost every assisted living facility has a woman who did this work.
Now, these women were in their early 20s back in the 1940s, and you found a pretty good number of them that were still alive and ready to talk about this.
Yes, more than 20. And some of them did have to be convinced that it was okay to tell the secret. One of the women in Maine, I really had to convince her that the oath of secrecy that they signed has now been lifted, and that the government, in fact, would love for them to tell their story. But I did find more than 20 women really all over the country who in some cases had to be convinced, but ultimately, you know, would all like to get credit for their contributions, completely understandably. And so they were eager and gratified to talk, and it was extraordinary what they remembered. Yeah. I mean, one woman living on Cape Cod who had been recruited out of Smith was able to show me the quite complicated math that she had had to do when she was working on breaking the Japanese naval code.
Yeah, I think she did columns in front of you and showed you how she did it, right?
Yeah, extraordinary. Yeah. Yes, exactly. She drew the columns, and she was recovering additives. I mean, basically, it was a numerical code, but it was encrypted by having more numbers added on to the numbers, and she had to figure out what the encryption was and strip it out in order to get down to the real numbers that had the message hidden in them. So these women were decrypting. This was an early form of hacking. They were hacking enemy communication systems, and the systems were encrypted, just like, you know, computerized communications are encrypted today, and computers are doing now what the women were doing during the war.
What were some of the skills the government was looking for in potential code breakers, and how did they go about finding these women?
So it was a fascinating program, particularly that the Navy conducted, working with professors and deans particularly at the Seven Sisters colleges. Much as they had done at men's schools like Harvard and MIT, they contacted math professors, astronomy professors, and asked them to tap certain senior girls who were good at math and science, but also at languages, because both of those skill sets are useful. But they were also looking for young women who were deemed to be patriotic and loyal. When I was doing research at Radcliffe, I came across these amazing files in which administrators were identifying the young women, and one of them said that they hadn't chosen a particular young woman because she had been spoiled by her mother, and they didn't think that she would be able to sort of persist in the work and take it seriously. So they were also looking for young women who were persistent and likely to stick with it, because it is a very hard thing to do, and it does take a lot of tenacity and sort of what we would call grit today, a willingness to withstand frustration and failure until you get to the right answer.
Describe the opportunities for women after college at that time, even for those women who graduated at the top of their class from a prestigious college.
Yeah, and that's easy to do, and it can be done very quickly, because school teaching was really the only job that was consistently available even to the graduates of top women's colleges. Now, there were some women who aspired to go into medicine or law. There were a few schools that had a few spots available for women, but by and large, women were shut out of these professional graduate schools. And, you know, there was a bit of room in journalism for women, maybe who wanted to write for the society pages, but the barriers to professional career in the late 1930s, early 1940s were enormous, even for these very top women. So this was an extraordinary opportunity for them to use their education and their talents in a way that ordinarily would not have been available.
Right. Have the colleges documented this history of their graduates?
Yes, to varying degrees. Wellesley has done a good job of recovering the recruitment program, but I think and Radcliffe to a certain degree, some more than others. When I was researching at the National Archives, I found rosters of all the graduates of these schools who were identified and came in 1942 1943, 1944. I even found the addresses that they stayed when they came to Washington. So there is a trove of material, I think, that could be used to further build this history. But there was a great article in the Wellesley Alumni Magazine in 2000, written by two female graduates, about those women's contribution to the program. And that was a great starting point for me, actually.
The National Security Agency wasn't created until after World War II. So the U.S. Army and the U.S. Navy had separate departments working on code breaking during the war. But they were in competition with one another. Explain that.
Yeah, well, anybody who lives in Washington knows that agencies compete with each other, particularly for appropriations. And during the war, so many of our agencies were established and got started. We really didn't have any intelligence agencies at the beginning of World War II, hard as that is to believe now. We didn't have the CIA, we didn't have the NSA, we didn't have the DIA, we didn't have much in the way of military intelligence. So they were ramping up really, really quickly after Pearl Harbor, which was a massive intelligence failure. And they were competing for glory, they were competing for appropriations, they were competing to be the first to break a code system. The Army was very chagrined because the Navy had broken the Japanese naval code before the Army was able to break the Japanese Army code system, because there were so many different systems. So there was a lot of competition, and there was competition for the women, and they were literally racing to get to certain colleges first. I came across a memo in which some Navy admirals were very angry that the Army had cut in to try and pick off some of their students, and the Army had gotten to Connecticut College before the Navy did, and so the Navy decided that they better at least give up on Connecticut College and let the Army have those young women.
You've got a funny little exchange about Polly Bunderbach and Agnes Driscoll after the war. Now we've got the Navy and the Army merging their operations and moving in. And you have here, even at her advanced age, Agnes Driscoll was capable of taking names and holding grudges. Though they had never been introduced, she must have known that Budenbach, thank you. Budenbach's mentor was Raven, the very man who did Miss Aggie in. As they passed each other in the hallway, neither woman spoke, but Agnes Driscoll did let out an unmistakable hiss.
Yes, Agnes Driscoll was really instrumental in developing the Navy's code-breaking program. She was working on the Japanese Naval Fleet Code during the 1930s and diagnosed how it worked. And the only reason that we didn't know about Pearl Harbor, one of the reasons, was because they had changed the code books. But Miss Aggie, as they called her, got elbowed out after Pearl Harbor when there were some male intelligence officers who were coming in and sort of elbowed her out of the way. And so when this cohort of young women came in from the Seven Sister Schools, including Polly Budenbach, who you just mentioned, they really didn't have access to Agnes Driscoll and the few women who were their predecessors. And so they really weren't able to form alliances. And so that was a very interesting and funny exchange, actually. Mm-hmm. I mean, kind of funny.
Yeah.
From Polly Budenbach's oral history that was taken later.
Yeah. So what were some of the tasks that these women did once they were recruited?
So really every task you can think of, because the women comprised the bulk of the code-breaking forces domestically for both the Army and the Navy. And there were so many different systems. So there were some systems that consisted of numerical code groups. It might be a four-digit or a five-digit code group that would stand for the Japanese word for troops, or debarking, or embarking, or the word for maru, which was a supply ship. And that would be converted into, say, a five-digit code group. But then, as I said, another group of numbers would be added to that to further disguise it, and that would be radioed. We would intercept it. It would go to the women at the compound. They would set about trying to strip out the encryption, doing really the reverse math. They had some tricks to help them. They knew that the code, if they got down to a valid code group, they knew that it would be divisible by three, because that was a little trick that the Japanese built in to make sure that the code group was radioed correctly, that it wasn't garbled. So they learned tricks like the garble controls that the Japanese built in They learned to look for words like shogoichi, which stood for noon position, which a ship would say exactly where it was going to be at noon the next day, and they could get the message out to an American submarine commander who would be waiting at noon to sink the ship. So they were an assembly line in which they were stripping out numbers to get down to the original code group. Then it would get passed along, sometimes literally by a conveyor belt, to a next group of women who would be reading the code groups and actually, you know, constructing the messages. So it was a very well-designed assembly line, and that's just one code system that I've just described. That was the Japanese Navy. I mean, I could go on and on about the German Navy and the Enigma ciphers and the group of women, the team of women who were working those.
How much did the women know about their work?
It varied. Some of the assembly line women really only knew what they were doing. They knew that it was important, it was repetitive and stressful, but they did know that lives depended on it. But women who were deciphering the Enigma messages, which were completely different, they were scrambled German letters, they would read the finished messages. And similarly, the women at the end of the assembly line with the Japanese naval messages would know what the messages said. And sometimes foretold the movements of their own brothers, you know, ships or their boyfriend ships. And in fact, the women working the German naval messages knew about the D-Day landing as it was happening because they were reading the German naval messages describing the appearance of thousands and thousands of Allied ships on the horizon. So all during the D-Day landing, the women were reading the German messages. They didn't know how it was going exactly, but they knew that it was taking place, and that was an incredibly dramatic experience for the women. And I did have the memoirs of a Wellesley graduate who described that night very, very vividly.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing when you think about it, you know. And in our age of instant communication now, that wasn't so then, so that would be a pretty amazing feat to be able to do that, you know, as it's happening.
Absolutely. And even now in our age of instant communication, we don't necessarily know how certain battles are going.
True,
and,
true.
You know, in the various wars that we're fighting.
Yeah.
And also to be receiving the account of the opposing force.
Yeah.
It was, I think, very extraordinary and moving for the women.
So these young college women came to Washington, D.C. to work, but they were expected to find their own lodgings, which wasn't easy in the nation's capital during the war. But in many ways, this was liberating for women. Explain.
Yeah, it was liberating. I mean, many of these women, when they were recruited, particularly the women at the Seven Sisters, they were asked two initial questions. Do you like crossword puzzles, and are you engaged to be married? And the first answer, the best answer to the first question was yes. The best answer to the second was no, because they would figure that if you were engaged, maybe you wouldn't stick with the work, maybe you'd move to be with your husband. But a number of the women actually lied. They were so eager to get to Washington, serve the war effort, and in some cases eager to get out of engagements that they had mixed feelings about, that they said, no, I'm not engaged, even though they were. And Washington for them was an opportunity to live with other women on their own. Many of them had been in colleges where they were heavily chaperoned and their behavior was, constrained and observed. And all of a sudden they were living in group houses, they were living in boarding houses, they were living in dorms. In some cases they were living in barracks when the waves were created. Women accepted for voluntary emergency service and the women could join the military. But they were having a great time. They were exhausted. They were working on, 24-hour around-the-clock operations. So they were working three shifts. They might get off, they might work all night and get off in the morning. But they told me about, they would rent canoes. They would listen to the Washington Opera, singing on barges at the Watergate. They would go to movies. They would listen to chamber music at the Library of Congress. They would go to swing dancing. They would hear Frank Sinatra at the Club 400, go to the Willard Hotel. So they had, it was one of those odd times. They were having a fabulous time. And yet at the same time, they knew that the men that they loved, the men they were related to, the men they were going to marry, were out there fighting in the Atlantic and the Pacific. Mm. So it was a whirlwind.
Yeah. Now, once you track down the actual code girls? You mentioned some reticent to talk, some not so much, the one who still thought she needed to keep it a secret. But had they shared their contribution to the war effort with their families?
They really hadn't. And in many cases, they had spent their post-war years listening to their husband tell their children about his wartime contributions, you know, which of course were significant. But in some cases, the women had made more of a significant contribution to the war, and the women couldn't say anything. And in fact, one of the women whose memoir I read, she had applied to use her GI Bill to go to architecture school, and she was told that she applied to several top architecture schools. She was denied admission. They said, well, we're holding these spots open for men returning from the war. She said, well, you know, I was in the U.S. Navy, but she couldn't say, and my work sunk a convoy. Mm. She knew that that had happened, but she couldn't tell about it. And so she was denied admission to those architecture schools. But they really didn't think that they could tell anybody, even their husbands, what they had done. And somewhere about in the 1990s, when some memoirs and books about naval code breaking started appearing, some of them might start hinting to their families what they had done, but really none of them had laid it out in any kind of detail.
Imagine the shock of that. You've gone all these years, and all of a sudden, you know, mom's hinting, or grandma's hinting about, yeah, I know all about that. I mean, what a revelation that would be. In the book, you have a picture of Stephen Chamberlain. It says, after World War II ended, Stephen Chamberlain, operations officer for General Douglas MacArthur, declared the codebreakers shortened the war and helped save thousands of lives. The post-war accolades did not mention that more than 10,000 U.S. codebreakers were women. So what were their views about having their contributions kept secret for so long?
Well, I think at first they recognized that this was necessary. Of course, they had been told during the war that they couldn't talk about what they did, and they understood and accepted that even after the war was over, we didn't want the world knowing the extent to which we had been able to break codes, because the World War II was followed by the Cold War, and we continued breaking the codes of communist countries and other countries. And so they understood that we can't reveal sources and methods, and they, you know, most of them went into private life and had children and families and accepted that. But I think, you know, at a certain point, they did feel as though they had been overlooked. And it must have been quite galling to have a member of Congress on the floor of the House say, you know, I believe that our cryptographers during the war played as an important part in victory as any other group of men, and have it just completely be not mentioned that that more than half of the code-breaking force was women.
Yeah.
I mean, how could that not irritate you?
Yeah, for sure. You mentioned the Enigma code. What were some of the achievements these women code-breakers had?
Yes, so they were working the German naval codes used by the U-boats. U-boats were, you know, throughout the Atlantic. I think many of us don't realize how menacing they were, because at one point during the war, they were preying on American merchant shipping up and down the Atlantic. So a lot of the women from the Eastern Seaboard were very aware of the U-boats. There were blackouts. They would hear the guns. They would see bits of shipwreck washing up. The women described this to me. Once they got to the naval facility in Washington, they were ultimately running every bit of this code-breaking operation. The Enigma machine, there was Enigma machine in every U-boat, and it had four rotors that would scramble the letters of the messages every day, and that setting would change every day or every 2 days. So the first job they had to do was figure out what the daily setting was, and that took, that was like figuring out a computer menu. They would get the garbled messages that the rotors had scrambled it. They knew where in a message certain German words might appear, like weather forecast in the Bay of Biscay. They knew where that might be, so they would conjecture, you know, that certain letters might really be Bay of Biscay or Biscaya in German. And then they would figure out the mathematical set of permutations that the machine would have to go through in order to scramble certain letters into another letter. And that was just the beginning. Then they would test it on these big machines. And if the machine got a hit, they would know that they had gotten the key for the day. Then they would plug that key into a smaller machine that would actually decipher the message, which would come out in German. The young women who knew German would translate those messages, and then they would write up a daily intelligence report for the U.S. Navy and also the British Navy, because they were in close contact with the British, who were also working on these codes. In fact, I interviewed the son of one woman who spoke every day over a secure phone line to a colleague in England, and her code name was Pretty Weather, and his code name was Virgin Sturgeon. And they obviously had a communication, you know, daily relationship. They never met each other for their entire lives.
You mentioned there's 10,000 women, so I know you don't know what happened to all of them, but what happened to these women after the war? I mean, many of them went off and got married, as you said, and they didn't really have careers. They became mothers and housewives.
Right. Many of them, and I would say the majority, went off and went into private life, but not all did. A number of them did get PhDs using the GI Bill. A number of them did stay in the workforce. The woman I talked about who had was rejected by architecture schools, she moved with her husband to Charlottesville, where he was teaching, Charlottesville, Virginia at UVA. But she taught herself computer programming. And when they eventually moved to Cincinnati, she became the head of the computer program for the university, you know, like the head of basically computer IT for that whole university system. So a number of the women found their way back into the workforce and the computer industry, and a number of women stayed on with what became the NSA, like Polly Budenbach, a woman named Ann Kara Christie, who rose to become the first female deputy director of the NSA. So they were breaking codes during the Cold War as well, in some cases heading up our code breaking for the East German project, the Soviet project, the Cuban messages. So there was a group of women who were there at the formative stages of the NSA.
And you think about how difficult it was for some of these women to return to a society where no one knew of their achievements and they had little opportunity to continue their careers. I guess some satisfaction in knowing you helped the war effort, but also a bit of frustration, I would think.
Yes, and I talked very, very much so. I mean, it was hard making the transition to regular life, and of course that was true for returning men as well. And some of the women had what their families considered to be PTSD. The women in particular working the German naval codes, because they had to work so fast and because the consequences of failure were so drastic, it was very stressful on them. But I was particularly struck, there was one group of women for the Navy who became very, very close friends, and after the war, when they all had to go back into pretty isolated private lives and they missed each other, they started something I'd never heard of called a round robin letter, in which one woman would write a letter, send it to the other woman, she would write her letter, send both of them on to the third woman, who would write her letter and send it on, and it would travel full circle, and when it came back to the first woman, she would write a new letter and then send it on. And that round robin letter continued until my reporting. I mean, I interviewed one of the women who, there were just two women left, and they were sending the round robin letter back and forth. So it got them through really everything that they went through in their lives after the war.
Mm. And I wondered if you'd talk about Dot for a moment, where, you know, Dot never told anybody what she did, and then maybe about 50 years after the war ended, she started to maybe hint a little bit. She didn't want to come right out and say it.
Right. Dot Braden is 97. I'm going to see her again in a week. I talked to her last night. She was a school teacher in Chatham, Virginia, which is down there on the Virginia-North Carolina border, 22 years old, overwhelmed by her teaching load, was recruited by the Army, came to Washington, and was one of a group of school teachers who were sinking the Japanese supply ships, doing the same mathematical procedures I've described. And after the war, she never told anybody. Her children knew that her husband had been a meteorologist during the war. Her children knew that their mother and father had corresponded and even become engaged over letters during the war. They didn't necessarily know that Dot was actually writing to like five or six different men, which was pretty common during the war for women. But they never knew what she did. And they were, once she started hinting at it, you know, maybe 10 or 15 years ago. Her children and grandchildren were avid to know more. And in my initial interview where I was trying to persuade her to talk, her son was there with her because he had wanted really all his adult life to know what his mom did. And between the two of us, we convinced her. At one point, she said, well, you know, I'm in my 90s. What are they going to do at this point? You know, put me in prison. Right. And I said, well, it'll probably be a nice prison, you know, at your age. And she laughed. And finally, you know, unspooled this incredible story.
Yeah. And what a gift, 97 years old, to be able to hear firsthand her and the other women who are also, you know, in their 90s. What a great gift to be able to hear from them their story firsthand.
I was so aware of that. I felt, it sounds cliched, but I felt really very honored that they entrusted me with their story, and I just could hardly believe my good fortune that that I would get to work on it and try to, you know, tell it as well as I could.
And now that the book is out, are you getting letters or emails or things from other people saying, hey, I have a story too?
Yes, I am. And it's sort of, I mean, it's great, but it's sort of frustrating. I've gotten probably 30 or 40 emails from people saying, you know, my mother did this work. My grandmother did this work. Here's photos. Oh, by the way, we have audio tapes. Oh, by the way, you know, my grandmother's still alive and living in an assisted living facility and would love to talk to you. So I realize that I could have researched this story for another year or another couple of years. So maybe some of their accounts will show up in, you know, a forward to a new edition or something.
Yeah, I know.
It is great.
Yeah, I was going to say, you can never get everybody that, no matter how many times you're researching, you're not going to find everybody at once.
Right, at a certain point, you just have to start
writing.
You have
to do it, yeah. The book is Code Girls, The Untold Story of the American Women Codebreakers of World War II. We'll have a link with more information about the book at our website, capeandislands.org. Author Liza Mundy, thanks so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Coming up after break, the story of a woman who was among the honored dead in the American cemetery in Normandy.